Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So President Biden came back from his ice cream party at Camp David to address the nation about not only the decision to withdraw, but withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan in toto, but how, of course, it transpired with the Saigon Redux images over the weekend as the Taliban has assumed control of that country and the implications of that both for Afghanis as well as our national security interests. So he needed to justify his decision. Here's what he offered.
Under his agreement, U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just a little over 3 months after I took office. U.S. forces had already drawn down during the Trump administration from roughly 15,500 American forces to 2,500 troops in country. And the Taliban was at its strongest militarily since 2001. The choice I had to make as your president was either to follow through on that agreement or be prepared to go back to fighting the Taliban in the middle of the spring fighting season. There would have been no ceasefire after May 1. There was no agreement protecting our forces after May 1. There was no status quo of stability without American casualties after May 1. There was only a cold reality of either following through on the agreement to withdraw our forces or escalating the conflict and sending thousands more American troops back into combat in Afghanistan.
That was false choice number one that he presented, starting with the Trump agreement that he inherited. And again, we discussed this a bit yesterday, the idea that he inherited this agreement. So it's an inevitability. Well, you know, his hands are tied. Hardly, as we've seen with respect to attempting to resuscitate the Iran nuclear deal, for example, in addition to his moves to reverse all sorts of Trump policies. He can make a different choice. Number one. Number two, that agreement had contingencies, had conditions, and those conditions had been violated at present. So this sort of fictional ceasefire that would have expired May 1 and would have resulted in our troops, the 2,500 non-combat troops, really military advisors. Again, we have not had a combat fatality in Afghanistan in 18 months. So that precedes by a significant period of time the Trump sort of framework of an agreement with the Taliban. That's just a false choice he's presenting. We would have either had to escalate or we're out. There's nothing in between. Well, there is something in between, and it was essentially what we were doing. So that was one issue.
And we have bases all over the world. Why not keep a base there in Kabul? I mean, my God, it was an American surrender that leaves the whole world unsafe. But let's go back to Biden and his deflecting, him blaming other people.
Well, he continued with offering false choices.
The Afghan military collapsed sometime without trying to fight. If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
Again, either we do it or it doesn't get done. That's a false choice. And it's also there's layers of fallacious reasoning here, including the notion that continues to be pushed that the Afghan security forces just rolled over.
66,000 Afghan national military and police have died. That's so, hardly rolling over.
Right. You sent the signal that you're not going to have American backing. You're not going to have our intel services and you're not going to have our air power. And so they said, well, America's pulling out and we better figure out how we're going to survive in a Taliban controlled Afghanistan. So that's, you know, you set, you offer the predicate decision and you get an understandable response. And then you say, well, they just rolled over. They didn't just roll over. They responded to the policy that you advanced. That's not the same thing. And then also, too, I mean, this is really something. This guy, he's spending.
He went back to vacation, by the way.
Spending money.
Oh, he brought up cash. That's right.
And our true strategic competitors, China and Russia, would love nothing more than the United States to continue to funnel billions of dollars and resources and attention into stabilizing Afghanistan indefinitely.
For 2,500 U.S. troops? I mean, let's be real here. We spend $34 billion annually to house troops in Japan and South Korea. We have 35,000 troops in Germany. Trump wanted to reduce that by about a third, and Biden reversed that move to redeploy approximately a third of the troops in Germany. So this idea, 2,500 troops in Afghanistan, that this is what I won't spend billions on. I'll spend trillions on everything else, but I won't spend billions on this. And not just to spend, but if it makes sense, if you don't have confidence that the country can and the Afghan security forces can maintain some stability there in terms of pushing back the Taliban, and then what you think the implications are of Taliban-controlled Afghanistan for America's national security. Does it become another haven for Islamic terrorism? And we're going to talk to Dr. Zudi Jassy from the American Muslim Forum for Democracy at well, a little bit later on the show to get his perspective on that, too. But I mean, the speciousness of what President Biden offered yesterday was really
embarrassing.
Breathtaking.
I mean, he's so unfit to be president. And where the leftist groups complain about the women, that's a different issue. But the women that have now have to go back to a life they don't want to live of absolutely zero freedoms. Where's the squad?
Nancy Pelosi said, we're deeply concerned about reports regarding the Taliban's brutal treatment of all Afghans, especially women and girls. The U.S., the international community, and the Afghan government must do everything we can to protect women and girls from inhumane treatment by the Taliban. Isn't she cute?
That's so nice of her.
Isn't
she
so
darling?
To take
time out of her busy day to do that.
You just turned the country over
to thugs.
Islamist fundamentalists who will reimpose Sharia law.
They're already going door to door looking for women for their army. And young girls for their men in the army.
These are just words. These are just words our politicians say today to make themselves sound concerned and engaged. Linda Thomas Greenfield, she's our U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Here were her words, a la Nancy Pelosi, on the occasion of the Taliban ascendancy.
Civilian populations, including journalists and non-combatants, must be protected. Attacks against civilians or civilian objects must stop, and the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all Afghan citizens, especially women, girls, and members of minority groups, must be respected.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The Taliban doesn't play your sort of neo-Marxist woke reindeer games.
They don't care.
Ambassador Greenfield. You turn over a country, I mean, and you do so in such a spectacularly catastrophic way.
Well, the world can see this, yeah.
And then you come back and say, hey, you totalitarians, hey, take care of those girls, won't you? You're going to respect everybody's rights, aren't you? I mean, is
this serious?
They
already dismantled all the beauty salons. They took it down because the Taliban's not going to have that. Back to wearing burqas.
Is this serious? And then you have, of course, the media falling right in to offer their words. These dodos like
Which one?
Clarissa Ward, who's a CNN foreign correspondent, now headscarf clad. She wasn't 48 hours ago. She was yesterday.
They're just chanting death to America, but they seem friendly at the same time. It's utterly bizarre.
At the president.
That's equivalent to them saying there's peaceful protests going on in Kenosha while buildings are burning behind them.
They're mostly peaceful. Yeah, they say death to America, but it's mostly peaceful. They're nice.
The tone's nice, Dan. Yeah.
They're saying death to America, but they seem otherwise nice. Well, you know what, Clarissa Ward? You may want to check back and see if once they're completely installed and America is completely gone, if that still holds up. If they're more sort of the death to America crowd, or they're more, you know, but they're pleasant about it. It's just a rhetorical position they're taking.
Unbelievable. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And, of course, if you served in Afghanistan, lost a loved one, we would love to hear from you because I feel so bad for all of those people. And yesterday, that disgraceful, sickening C-17 taking off and five people falling to their deaths because they were so desperate they were clinging to a plane. That's going to be indelibly etched in the minds of people around the world forever.
Leon Panetta, who you may remember was CIA director, defense secretary, Obama's first two terms. I think in many ways, I think of John Kennedy in the Bay of Pigs. It unfolded quickly. The president thought everything would be fine. It was not the case, but President Kennedy took responsibility for what took place. Is that what Biden did yesterday, take responsibility?
He deflected. And then this morning, the lead was, we're going to need a booster shot in 8 months, instead of the lead being what it should be, and that's this.
Mark on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah. Sure. Yes, good morning, Dan and Amy. The Afghan security forces, the only way they were able to neutralize the Taliban for years was with our air power, along with our allies, and along with the intelligence on the ground. Once that left, it was impossible. This was inevitable of what was going to happen. And the second point is, this is a worldwide story, and we get our president to give a speech at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Makes no sense.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Yeah, and earlier in the day, he was calling governors who were defying mask mandates and superintendents.
It was an inevitability, said Mark on the South Side. I'm sorry, Mark. I'm reading right here from the White House talking points on Afghanistan. And to the question of was this an intelligent failure, it was not an inevitability. It was a possibility. And the administration planned for every possibility. There were contingency plans in place for any eventuality, including a quick fall of Kabul. That's why there were troops pre-positioned in the region to deploy as they have done. Oh, so what we saw was part of the plan?
It's a pretty bad plan there, buddy.
It was not an inevitability. It was a possibility. These are White House talking points on Afghanistan. The talking point is going to be wrong, could they? Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. When you look at the debacle of what happened with the withdrawal combined with the media response, even Biden's own supporters in the media, and you combine all that with the internal problems here at home, I worry what this administration is going to do next foreign policy-wise because, they already blew it in Afghanistan. Now you have China emboldened to where they could possibly take Taiwan. Now, what if that actually happened? What would Biden do? Would he respond militarily? Because that's a place worth defending. I mean, that's a pretty important place to the West economically and elsewhere. And the thing is, you have a public now that's so anti-war, including myself, that it would be hard for them to justify any kind of military action, especially when the Congress hasn't declared war since World War II.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, Taiwan in all due time. You know, the Chinese communists are in no rush. And by the way, neither are the Taliban. You know, these are entities that think about things in years, in decades, not in days like we do. They don't need the instant gratification. They'll wait you out. And they'll pick their moment. Oh, and by the way, in terms of, China and Russia, particularly China, seeing us spend our money in places like Afghanistan to hold 2,500 military advisors there. I don't know if Joe Biden's noticed how the CHICOMs are spending their money everywhere, including in the Western Hemisphere, as the setup for their play to become the world superpower to depose the United States. You may want to take notice of that as well. I know he's on top of it because foreign policy is his strong suit, Joe Biden, right?
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Brian Williams, or Commander McBragg, as he's better known. He somehow still has a job in media. I mean, if you consider MSNBC media, which I barely do.
I mean, have you ever turned on MSNBC?
Only yesterday to watch Matt Zeller, who's the co-founder of No One Left Behind. He's an Afghan vet. He's a Afghan war vet, U.S. vet, former CIA analyst. And he received Commander McBragg's characterization of the Biden speech and offered quite the rejoinder.
Didn't run from it. He owned it. He owned his decision. He owned the fact that, as he put it, the buck stops with him.
I hope he gets to own their deaths, too. Yeah. I feel like I watched a different speech than the rest of you guys. I was appalled. There was such a profound, bold-faced lie in that speech. The idea that we planned for every contingency. I have been personally trying to tell this administration since it took office. I've been trying to tell our government for years that this was coming. We sent them plan after plan on how to evacuate these people. Nobody listened to us. They didn't plan for the evacuation of our Afghan wartime allies. They're trying to conduct it now at the 11th hour. The thing that they were most concerned about was the optics of a chaotic evacuation. Well, they got exactly what they were most concerned of by failing to do what was right when we could have done it. We had all the people and equipment in place to be able to save these people months ago, and we did nothing. I'm appalled that he thinks we only need to take 2,000 people. There's 86,000 people who are currently left behind in Afghanistan alone. We've identified all of them for the government. I have no idea why he claims that people don't want to leave Afghanistan. I have a list of 14,000 names right now of people who want to get out of Afghanistan. And the idea that the Afghan military should be blamed for this, do you know how many casualties the Afghan military took in an average year? More than the United States did in 20. When you're not getting paid on a regular basis, when you're not getting fuel, when no one is supplying you with ammunition, and yet you're still showing up to the fight, how dare us for having to blame these people for not having the audacity to be able to survive a Taliban onslaught? No. What we need to be doing right now, and what I am appalled that the president didn't say, was we need to be talking about how we're going to get every single one of these people out. Because let's be abundantly clear. People like me looked these people in the eye and made them a promise. We promised them that in their time of need, we would take care of them. How do you ever expect anyone to ever trust us again if we don't do that now while we can? And I'm sick and tired of trying to defer the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan on what we're going to do. We're the United States of America. They're terrified of us. I have Afghans on the ground right now who are telling me they're going door to door in Kabul and they're making lists of people who used to work with us. They're telling them with smiles on their face, evil smiles, that they're going to be back from them once we leave. So we either take them now or these people are going to die. I've been trying to tell anyone who will listen. This is a never again moment in the making. This is an administration that seems to be a profound champion and defender of human rights. Well, sometimes human rights have to be defended at the barrel end of a gun. The Taliban are a modern version of the Nazis. And if this was Dresden, do you think British, or sorry, not Dresden, if this was Dunkirk, do you think British, yachting pilots, the British captains that were sailing their boats heroically into Dunkirk, do you think they were asking on the beaches if the people they were picking up were Brits or French? Or do you think they were just trying to get people away from the Nazis? Every Afghan we leave behind is going to be left behind to a horrible existence. And if we don't take them now while we can, that is as much on us as it is on the Taliban, who will hang or behead them.
Does that clear it up for you? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. There's the press release politician, like Joe Biden, dutifully reading his prepared talking points. The administration planned for every possibility. There were contingency plans in place for any eventuality, including a quick fall of Kabul. Really? Obviously, the difference between a press release politician and a doer, this now nonprofit co-founder, No One Left Behind, Matt Zeller, who's a war veteran and former CIA analyst and is doing the work.
He's doing all the heavy lifting.
And, you know, it's a remarkable thing. It's sort of an extension of our conversation yesterday. You have these nonprofits out there with people who know the terrain and the dynamics and are putting together all the necessary information. All they need is government authorization and some resources to execute in terms of keeping our promises to those who allied with American forces in Afghanistan. And you still can't get it done.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Something else that Zeller said I think is sort of interesting, because it's perhaps something that we need to consider. As you know, there's layers to this. The immediate issue is exactly what Zeller outlined. It's keeping our promises to our allies, keeping our promises to people who put their lives on the line to side with the United States to try to prevent totalitarians from lording over their country yet again. But there's this other thing he said. We're the United States of America. They're terrified of us.
Not anymore.
We're the United States of America. This is what Takir Fano was referring to yesterday in our conversation when he talked about being embarrassed, and Americans don't like to be embarrassed. This is embarrassing. And really, generally, across the political spectrum, there's virtual consensus, maybe with the exception of the CNN staff, that this was an embarrassing, indefensible occurrence.
Well, Jake Tapper took it to President Biden on CNN. Well, I'm just saying that of the
he noted the obvious. When you send 6,000 troops in after you're removing 2,500 troops, that's called a failure. Yeah, obviously. So, yes, the congratulations for the obvious not escaping Jake Tapper for change.
Well, Adam Kinzinger.
I don't care about Adam Kinzinger.
Well, he blames Trump.
I know. This is performance. Don't care. I'm going to have a conversation with serious people. Adam Kinzinger is no longer one. He impersonated one for a period of time. Now he's no longer one. He's just a never Trump bot.
Right.
So he's just another version of a press release politician, unfortunately. But that's what it is. We're America. You know, I understand we had a caller before the news, our friend from Plano, saying, you know, we're the superpower, but because we have bungled so many forays into war, whether it was for retribution or for the protection of a foreign people or whatever, we've bungled this so many times that you have people that want America to be a superpower, recognize the importance of America's status as the world's only superpower, and are skeptical of our use of force, you know, when it's compelled. This is a sort of a complicated question because of the performance of the federal government not our military men and women on the ground, but I mean the decision makers, the strategists, the intelligence community, et cetera. Do you want America to be Switzerland? Do you think America can take a posture, you know, sort of a Ron Paulish posture of being Switzerland, no foreign entanglements, no interventions, and certainly the use of force only if we're directly attacked? You think we can take that position and still be the world superpower? And if we're not the world superpower, you understand there are implications to that in terms of our quality of life and so forth. And this gets into matters financial as well, the standing to be the reserve currency, which is frankly tethered to the standing of our ability to use force to impose our will, hopefully when it's appropriate and called for. As Matt Zeller said, sometimes you need to enforce human rights at the barrel of a gun. He's right. And so that's, you know, a basis for a legitimate use of force. But you think we can be Switzerland and still be the world superpower? And if we're not the world superpower, do we have an appreciation of what that means for maybe not the quality of life we enjoy if we're of a certain age, but certainly generations that are coming behind us? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Chris in Libertyville.
Hey there, Dan and Amy. I spent 2 years in Afghanistan when I was in the Army. And I'd say my attitude now with all of this happening is crestfallen. I got to talk to locals, people that were genuinely happy that we were there and grateful for breaking them out of Sharia law. And now they're just going to be going back into it. You know, public policy aside, I feel for the people. Some of the people that I got to meet and that were just absolutely grateful of us being there. So that's just the only comment I wanted to make.
Thanks, Chris,
for your service. And they seem more grateful than Americans that are living here.
Well, you know, I won't be the first commentator to make this point, but those those who are unfairly characterizing the Afghan people who fought the Taliban as just rolling over, including the president of the United States, Joe Biden.
Yeah, you blame them.
Are so many of the same people that are thrilled to give up their individual liberties in this country under any pretense that involves safety. I mean, you had 66,000 Afghan dead fighting against totalitarians in their country. How many people are fighting against wannabe totalitarians in this country? I mean, it's not Taliban Sharia law types. And it's not beheadings, at least not yet. But I mean, that they're inclined in the same direction.
Well, we're talking about giving up freedoms. Yeah.
Peggy in Chicago.
Hi. Well said. Well said. Somebody had to say it. You know, the only people that are speaking out, you're speaking out, and I think the overnight Red Eye Radio is speaking out. And it's so incredibly horrific that these people are being slaughtered like this. Our own people are being slaughtered, and there's no one to help. No one's helping. This could have been planned a long time ago. People are saying this, that all this could have been avoided, and it was not. This guy, the president, goes on vacation. What kind of craziness is this? The thing that I wanted to say, though, is that if these people die, we will die.
Thanks.
Your kids will die. And you know, God is fair. You know, it's like you slaughter your own people over there, somebody's going to come over here and slaughter your kids. The Taliban has people are coming across the southern border, honey, and 5,000 a day. And not everybody is for you, you know what I mean? And like they get over here and they think, oh, I can do this. Watch your back, honey.
Thanks.
Because you're going to go.
Thanks for the call, Peggy. 21-year high. The number of migrants encountered illegally coming across the border has reached a 21-year high, to her point. It's a legitimate one if you want to have the national security conversation.
Yeah. And who's covering that at the border?
Robert in Bloomingdale.
Good morning. You know what? After 20 years of war, America's Afghanistan, Afghans going house to house in Afghanistan, blaming Pakistan for everything while giving Pakistan foreign aid. How much longer do we have to waste our time listening to generals who, for the last 15 years, told us how great Afghanistan's progressing into democracy? It was all a bunch of bullshit.
Bull jive, I think, is the term you were looking for.
Yeah, remember we're going to have, like, gambling junkets, trips to Afghanistan. They're going to Americanize it.
Pakistan, the Pakistani Prime Minister, Imran Khan, congratulated the Taliban, saying that Afghans have broken the shackles of slavery by reasserting control of that country. So, yes, our security ally, in quotation marks, in Pakistan, they provided a Taliban safe haven across Afghanistan's southern border, which was crucial to the Taliban's survival. That's what our security partner, Pakistan, did in this matter. And right, and you had Trump withdraw foreign aid from Pakistan. And that should be the beginning of our reassessment of our relationship with Pakistan, it seems to me. Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah,
all these geopolitical issues, complicated, a lot of actors. And so this is where you have to have sort of hard and fast principles you're working from and not, you know, the political calculation that's most expedient, the talking point that you can find most persuasive to absolve yourself of responsibility. That may work for the D.C. press corps. It doesn't work if your interest is America's security and your interest is in extending freedom wherever you can, including by leading by example. Chet and Lyle.
Yes, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, it's obviously a sad day for America the last few days, but also it's a particularly sad day for all the people who served there, families who maybe gave up a family member there, and people who are wounded, in some cases permanently. Yeah. Give them a call. Send them an email and thank them. Thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
Chad's making me cry.
It's tough,
true. I mean, can you imagine how painful stuff. this watching yesterday was so embarrassing.
6,200 military and U.S. contractors dead, 20,000 wounded. Yeah.
And for what?
Serious business. Well, I mean,
what happened yesterday did not have to happen.
But Chris in Libertyville says for what, too? I mean, in terms of, I think, the perspective of a lot of those who served. It's like we were on the side of the angels. We were doing good work. We were helping people who don't want to live
under Sharia law.
Under Sharia law, don't want to be persecuted by their government. And we did our job. You know, the brass, well, that's another story. Jimmy on the inbound Edens.
Yeah, I just want to hope that this Mark Milley general, if you want to call him a general, had a chance to vet all these 6,000 troops going back in for critical race theory, their views, make sure there's no white supremacists there, and I hope to hell they're fully vaccinated, because mm-hmm. this would be a national crisis right now.
Yeah.
And they have masks on, of course.
Of course.
What a joke our military leadership is. They're a joke.
Well, General Mark Milley he needs to get fired. I mean, remember what he said a few weeks ago, folks?
The Afghan security forces have the capacity to sufficiently fight and defend their country. Oh. A negative outcome, a Taliban automatic military takeover, is not a foregone conclusion.
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. We got the talking point. Thanks, General.
Yeah, thanks.
Follow-up question. What happens if and when we pull out and they don't have intel and air power supremacy, what do you think happens then? That was 3 weeks ago he said that,
yeah.
The end of July. But no, to Jimmy on the Eden's point, yeah, all of those 6,000 troops that were deployed were required to read How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi before they were allowed to go try to save people clinging to C-17s at the airport in Kabul.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Some rallies yesterday against the mask mandates for kids in school. There was one out to Wheaton-Warrenville, School District 200. A bunch of parents out there with some creative signs. We'll post some pictures. There was also one that I mentioned yesterday that was in Lake County, Indiana.
Yeah, near St. John. Yep.
The high school there, Lake Central High School.
There was a huge one there. That was good for them.
Yeah. And apparently there was some sort of back and forth at a Joliet school board meeting yesterday. And I know that from this Next News outlet doing the reporting here, because a dude was arrested for not wearing a mask.
Do you need help, Tim? Tim, you want us to come to the station?
Call Rick.
Someone call. Tim, who wants to call?
Took him out of cuffs.
Tim, who do you need us to call? Who are we calling, Tim? Tim, who are you calling? Who are we calling? Who are we calling?
The phone, cigarettes.
What happened?
Dave Sotokas, get a hold of
Dave Sotokas.
Jim, what happened?
Dave Sotokas.
He's exempt from a mask.
Yeah, I'm exempt.
Medically exempt from a mask? I wouldn't be putting him in a car in handcuffs.
I told him not to do this. Oh, my God.
Posted. What is he being arrested for?
That's ridiculous. You'll be sued and you'll be debadged. Ridiculous.
They posted nothing.
Just doing their job. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Are you serious?
Crime.
Are you serious? Arresting somebody? What are you?
The police enforced an ordinance and arrested him, citing him with a municipal fine and a citation, charging him officially with criminal trespassing. It's reported that Conrad suffers from clinical PTSD, and his doctor says he physically cannot wear one. Here's a question, though. Could this be retribution? Conrad previously served the school board a public notice on their disregard for people with medical disabilities to remove masks.
So they removed him from the meeting.
That's right. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I hear that and it makes me sick to my stomach. That is America. That is what we've become. We're arresting people for not wearing masks? Are you people serious?
You know, trying to crawl in the minds of some people, it's a challenge. I guess it's just most people just think the costs that have been imposed are not unreasonable, right? I don't know how else to understand it. And, the funny thing about this, and I don't want to take this comparison too far, but the takeaway from Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil, her examination, the celebrated 20th century political scientist, her examination of the Adolf Eichmann trial in Israel. The takeaway, banality of evil, it sort of is indicated in the title. You think that, well, I know Officer Joe. He's never going to do that to us. I know Village Board Member Smith. She's never going to do that to us. You know, our kids go to the same school, play Little League together. I grew up with
his brother.
Business leader Jones. They're not going to go fall in with this. The banality of evil. It's funny how good people do bad things when rooted in fear, perhaps a misplaced sense of self-preservation. It seems to me that the lockdowns and everything that's transpired since the gradual reopening started and was sort of halted and just starting more in some places, again, and more in some places than others. It just seems to me people say the costs are not that significant. Okay. Everything's fine. And it's never going to go to a place where I think the costs are too high. Well, okay. Well, that'll be an interesting conversation when you're sitting in a gulag next to your neighbor. I mean, I'm being a bit dramatic here, okay? But it is a continuum. And the things that you don't think can happen. How many things have transpired in the last 18 months that you didn't think could happen?
The list is long, my man.
Right. So people watching this guy get taken out in cuffs. Who would prosecute a resident of their community who's at least interested enough in what's going on at the schools to show up at a school board meeting? And that's very few people. And he apparently had like a legitimate doctor's note for not wearing a mask. There's not even a mask mandate to be indoors except locally.
Right.
And at a village, at a school board meeting.
Yeah.
But that's really how you're going to treat your neighbor?
Your fellow American?
That's really how a school board member is okay seeing a constituent treated? I mean, if he was violent, if he was disrupting the meeting, not allowing business,
but
that's one thing.
But he wasn't.
There's no indication of that. And the charges weren't disorderly conduct, it was criminal trespass because he can't be there if he doesn't wear his mask, even though he can't wear a mask, so we understand, per his doctor's orders. That's really where you want this to go. And if it is, and if you're okay with it and it's not a big deal, then where else do you think this can go?
Well, I mean, look what happened to Jay Cutler. He got dropped from an Uber Eats ad because he's anti-masks in school. And he's actually going to run for school board in Franklin, Tennessee. And he even, you know, tweeted out, well, I freeze up my weekend. Unbelievable.
Will Kristen Cavallari endorse him?
No.
David,
she's not taking him back, Dan. It's over.
David and Wheaton.
Hey. Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. How you doing?
Hello.
I was at the protest yesterday. I was in Plainfield. It wasn't in Joliet.
Oh, this...
there might have been...
This arrest?
Yes, this arrest was in Plainfield, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, so what happened? Tell us what happened.
Okay.
So I was not at the meeting. I was outside. I was in front. I'm with an organization called Restore Illinois, and we're trying to organize people.
Oh, are you the guy that he said called? No,
that's Dave Shistokas.
Oh, that's not
attorney.
You. Okay.
Yeah, no, okay. Different Dave.
Okay, all right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And so it's just we're trying to get parents to be a voice at school board meetings. I mean, you know, a year ago we didn't have anybody, and now we're getting, you know, 50 here, 100 there, and we're trying to get people so that they know they have a voice. They can't stand up to, you know, whether the governor's making these fake mandates, and they can stand up to their school boards and be a presence and make a difference. And a lot of people just go along, like you were saying earlier, Dan, you know, a lot of things that are happening right now. A year ago, you would have looked at that and said, nah, this will never happen. Well, it's happening, and we have to make a stand right now. What's interesting is you get a lot of people on social media that will say, you know, I can't wait for the day for people to start standing up and doing something. Well, you know, they need to start draining us because we don't have the numbers. We have people who are trying to stand up and do something, but we don't have enough people. So that's where we're at. But the gentleman that did get arrested, he apparently did have a doctor's approval to, he had a condition where he didn't have to wear a mask. I believe he is vaccinated, but, you know, it's just a matter of principle. You know, the school board a couple weeks earlier voted to make masks optional, and then our right. governor said no, you know, and he changed the whole spectrum now, and now he's made it a you know, a law that we have to, and this is what's angering a lot of people. What happened in the past 2 weeks to change everybody's mind?
Right. Right. Thanks for the call, David.
And it's sick. I was at University of Chicago yesterday during the first peak. That's when they had their most hospitalizations, about 160. During the second one, you know, last November, December, 100 people in the hospital. Guess how many people are in the hospital today at University of Chicago? 19 with COVID. And he said, and they're coming in and out as quickly as we can, and we're doing well. I'm like, well, then why are we masking up again? Why are we doing all of this? And they don't know. Because of the cases, all about cases. Prince Grieven said that yesterday. Well, the cases are going up. When was this about cases? It always was about hospitalizations and the death rate.
Well, that changed a while ago. I mean, if we're being honest, in making this about cases and essentially taking a zero tolerance for COVID position, which is a, you know, natural world impossibility, that changed months and months ago. And so this is just a continuation of that because,
it's
again,
a cold. Some people don't even know they have it.
Because, again, the costs are too high to be informed. And the costs that are being imposed are not significant in the minds of enough.
And real quickly, yesterday, Chicago Public Schools came out and said grades 5th through 12, if you play sports, any sport at all, you have to provide a vaccination card by September 1st or submit to weekly testing. And if you do not comply with that, you cannot participate. Coaches have to kick the kids off their teams. Testing healthy kids, though.
Sorry I can't join you in feigning surprise. Joe in Lincoln Park.
Hey, you know, so much for following the science. This thing with the double, you know, the double testing, I thought that if you have the vaccination, you could also catch COVID. So why is it just picking on these people that didn't get the vaccination? Also, that guy that got arrested and they couldn't wear the mask, I pray to God he hires an attorney and sues that school board because they violated the ADA.
Yeah, right.
They should have made accommodations for him because he cannot wear a mask. Where were his accommodations? Get an attorney and sue them on a civil case and win millions from these idiots.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Mike in Griffith, Indiana.
This is why the Taliban took Afghanistan back. They don't want to have a Biden mask mandate imposed on them. They figured we might as well just take the place back now.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mike. Joe in his car.
Yeah, how you doing, Dan and Amy? Look, this guy that got arrested last night, it was ridiculous. They all should have took their masks off, and they shouldn't have allowed them to be taken off. This is not a law. It's a mandate imposed by a tyrannical governor who just thinks he can willy-nilly do whatever and say whatever he wants and sign a piece of paper. Yeah. Where is the people to stand up? This is ridiculous. We go to these school board meetings and we're there with 20 people. Where are the hundreds of people at with their kids that they allow? It's disgraceful. It's disgusting. And what we saw yesterday in Afghanistan is coming here. With that government, are you kidding me? It's time to stand up, parents. Protect your kids. They don't need a vaccination in the fifth grade. Are you kidding me? That's ridiculous. And if it means not playing sports, then the kid doesn't play sports. They don't know what's going to happen with these kids in the future with reproductive organs and things. It's an experiment. They're experimenting on our kids, and the parents are letting them do it. Shame on the parents that get these kids these shots. There is no children dying. Amy, you have said it. Three children, unfortunately, have died in the city of Chicago out of 300-some thousand kids. Are you kidding me? They're getting shot left and right, and the people don't do nothing about it. They're disgusting. And those people in Afghanistan, I'd take every single one of them that were running down that tarmac, and I'd stand right with them because they're real patriots, not these Antifa scumbag champagne socialists that you call them, Dan. They make me sick. And it's disgusting. We're Americans, and we stand up for our rights. We don't lay down and say, oh, it's nice and easy. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, that's the problem with this country. We haven't had any kind of pain. There is no bullet holes in the walls like in over in the Eastern Bloc. We've had it too easy for too long, and now it's time to stand up, and the people don't know how to do it because they want to have it nice and easy. Well, it's time to get tough. Stand up, parents.
All right.
That's what I got to say.
Thank you. Thank you,
God
Joe.
God bless you,
Appreciate
Joe.
It. Scott and Aurora.
Yeah, I got a question. I'm starting to hear that these big corporations are starting to have the, not the mask mandates, but the vaccine.
Mandates.
I'm not a Sue happy kind of person, but if somebody were to die from that vaccine, they can prove that they died from it. Could the family members sue for something like that?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Scott.
I thought that was off the table.
What you're basically seeing is, I mean, you can file a complaint with any legal claim that you want. But what we're seeing is that courts are holding that private actors, even public actors like, say, Indiana University, can impose mask mandates. Federal agencies, Veterans Affairs, HHS, can impose mask mandates. So
vaccine mandates.
Mandates. Right. So that's where it's at. Your employer, public sector or private sector, has a lot of latitude with respect to conditions of employment when it comes to public health. Anything under public health, under anything under safety. We had this conversation with Don Boudreau from George Mason University yesterday. His colleague is suing the university. He's over the vaccine mandate because he got sick. COVID, recovered. He has antibodies.
The antibodies are better and more effective than the vaccine.
Yeah, but he doesn't. I think he, in consultation with his doctor, thinks that the vaccine is an unnecessary risk. So he's suing over it. So we'll see if that case goes anywhere. I have my doubts. I don't think so. I don't think he's going to be successful. But that's where it's at. The courts have folded in to the state with regard to anything just about under the sun. And if you invoke the magic phrase, public health. Mary in Michigan City, Indiana.
Good morning. Good morning. I just ran across a quote from John Locke from the 1700s. Mm-hmm. A government derives its powers from the just consent of the governed. So if we don't speak up, if we don't, do anything, it's our own fault.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Victor at Midway.
Yes, morning, Dan, Amy.
Hello.
I applaud that one caller, Joe. He's right on. I mean, these parents got to wake up, quit being lazy, and go do something. But I think what I wanted to comment on was, I didn't hear anyone mention it, but what in God's name is wrong with that police officer who actually followed through on the orders to arrest that gentleman, knowing it's violating the civil rights? I mean, that's disgusting. I usually back the cops all the time. But on this situation, I might have to become a Democrat and defund the cops because they're the ones contributing to this fucking chaos.
Effing, dump that.
Guys, watch the fracking, language.
Fracking. People are upset.
They got
people
him for
upset.
Criminal trespassing? That's so... We're not wearing a mask? That it is a recommendation from the CDC. The CDC also recommends that we, you know, allow kids to exercise for 60 minutes a day. Have one drink if you're a woman.
Who cares what
two
the CDC
if you're a man.
Says.
I know it's a bunch of nonsense. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
I'm pointing it out.
The cops. You really want to take somebody out in cuffs? And again, the school board members who wanted this, pressing charges ostensibly. Huh. You're going to put somebody in cuffs. There are three officers in the video I saw. And then give them an AO ticket for a criminal trespass? Somebody's going to be put in cuffs in the back of a squad car over this? Who's otherwise
peaceful?
He's going
to have to go to court?
You don't find that chilling at all. Nobody finds that chilling.
Did you tweet out
the
video?
Some people obviously do. But
Dan, did you tweet out the video?
Yeah, I will. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. This, I guess, is probably what it was like when Churchill was having to deal with his war cabinet in World War II. That's how these people's mentality is, like Lord Halifax. Except there is no Churchill for us today. It's a horrible situation. God is dead, too. One of your callers said, what in God's name? God is dead. That's the type of society we live in.
Okay,
secularized.
Nietzsche. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
God is not dead.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Well, yeah, he's not saying it.
Our freedoms are dead.
Well, they're inextricably linked, but that's a philosophical conversation for another day. By the way, I'll tweet this out. There's a really good piece. I mean, again, just if you want to share with your school boards or anybody that is actually
cares.
Open-minded on the topic and interested in understanding the impact of masks. Do Masks Work? A review of the evidence by Jeffrey Anderson, who's a former DOJ statistician.
Ooh.
And he goes through not only some of the studies on masks that render masks in terms of protection inconclusive or worse, but actually the studies that Francis Collins and the CDC, NIH and CDC, always rely on when they talk about the science is clear and the studies are in. He goes through them. It's very, very good piece, Jeffrey Anderson's piece. So you can check that out on my Twitter feed if you'd like.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And so the briefing yesterday, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby, there was a Afghan reporter. Her name is Nazir Karimi. And she offered this about what has transpired in her country.
Thank you so much, John. As you know, I'm from Afghanistan, and I'm very upset today because Afghan women didn't expect that overnight all the Taliban came. They took off my flag. This is my flag. They put their flag. Everybody is upset, especially women. And I forgot my question. What do you ask? Where is my president, former President Ghani? People expected that he bye-bye with the people. And immediately he ran away. We don't know where is he. And we don't have a president. President Biden said that President Ghani know. He has to fight for us people. They have to do everything, and we were able to financially help them. But we don't have any president. We don't have anything. Afghan people, they don't know what to do. Women has a lot of achievement in Afghanistan. I had a lot of achievement. I left from the Taliban like 20 years ago. Now we go back to the first step again. Do you have any comment? Where is our president, Rouhani? He should answer to Afghan people.
Well, I obviously can't speak for Ashraf Ghani or where he is or what his views are. I wouldn't do that. But let me say with all respect that that I understand, and we all understand, the anxiety and the fear and the pain that you're feeling. It's clear and it's evident. And nobody here at the Pentagon is happy about the images that we've seen coming out in the last few days.
Yeah, I feel your pain in lieu of I take responsibility for what we did and didn't do.
Well, was Pentagon and Biden on the same page on this?
They're reading from the same talking points. The administration planned for every possibility. There were contingency plans in place for any eventuality. That's what I'm reading right here from the White House talking points in Afghanistan. So it must be true. For more on this, pleased to be joined by, again, by Dr. Zudi Jasser. We haven't talked to in a while. Good to have him back. He's the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement. He's a former U.S. Navy lieutenant commander and author of A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Dr. Jasser, good to have you back.
It's great to be with you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
I don't understand why that journalist, Ms. Karimi, is so upset that Taliban announced that they want an inclusive government.
The Taliban is, as you know, Afghanistan's ISIS, and they're terrorists. They are 13th century at best. They will rule with the enslavement and torture of women, believing in a form of draconian Sharia law that will turn Afghanistan in total into basically Iran on steroids, in which women have no bodily autonomy. You know, I sat on the U.S. Commission on Religious Freedom for 4 years, and Afghanistan is still listed on the list of countries with special concern on special watch list, and that's even when the Taliban only ran 30-40% of the country. Yes, Afghanistan is a failed state. Yes, we should have essentially left there. But, you know, listen, I practice medicine and I'm a physician. When we discharge a patient from the hospital, we don't one day walk in the room and say, oh, well, you're ready to be discharged, or we're just going to throw you out the front door in a wheelchair onto the street. You plan it. There's a plan. And then sometimes patients succeed, sometimes they don't. But this was done by nitwits in the State Department and DOD. Because they really don't care. They betrayed the Afghani people. I'm talking about the Biden administration. And not only was there no strategy, it basically burned and turned on a dime 20 years of investment of the American population into Afghanistan in counter-terror operations. And it didn't have to be this way. We could have still left, but ownership is perception. And by doing it this way, we end up owning the departure that ruined the entire perception. And I can tell you, Dan, over the next generation, August 2021, this week, is going to be perceived as a tipping point in the weakness of America against the access of Islamism, be it from Afghanistan with the Taliban to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to the Khomeinists in Iran, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. Many of these ascending political Islamic Sharia states are going to see this as a time in which they got the green light. And America has not only gone militarily, strategically, and by the way, there's a short-term problem, which is what the Biden administration failed, and then there's a long-term problem, which is we never engaged the ideology of political Islam at all. So there's a lot of multiple pathologies here, but the bottom line is it didn't have to be like it happened in the last 10 days.
Dr. Jasser, I have so many questions, but why do we tell our enemies the date that we're leaving? Why would anybody do that? Give them that information.
I have no idea. It doesn't make any sense. It's because our so-called commander-in-chief has no wherewithal to understand what it is to lead strategy. And basically he did it because it had political points he thought he was going to make at the time. And his interns that just got out of Harvard or wherever they're from thought it might be smart to do. Meanwhile, many of us, the Biden administration won't even meet with Iranian dissidents. Last week, they sent a message to Iranian democracy activists in Washington. They won't meet with them. Why? Because Obama 3.0 is trying to rekindle this nuclear deal. And oh, surprise, they are evacuating Afghanistan at the same time on a dime. And this is all happening at the same time because globally, the far-left progressivists have been working closely with the Islamists. They think they're about human rights and feminism and gay rights. But at the end of the day, all the rainbow flags in Afghanistan are gone now. So I'm not sure what the left's principles are, but they really don't care about human rights. There's a bigotry of low expectations when it comes to Muslims, and it's on display this week in Afghanistan.
Interesting. That's an interesting comment. You mentioned Pakistan. The prime minister there, Imran Khan, was positively giddy upon hearing the Taliban had ascended to control of Afghanistan. I mean, considering he provided safe haven for them in Pakistan, it would stand to reason. But he said that they have broken the shackles of slavery, the Taliban has. So how should we understand our ally in the region, Pakistan, and what do you think happens with all of those Islamist terrorist organizations that you mentioned in the region in the wake of this?
That's a great question, and you hit the nail on the head. Imran Khan, I'll remind folks, is a former soccer player that campaigned on the fact that he thought he was coming up to counter the Islamists, was sort of a normal secular dude with girlfriends and other things, and he pretended to be non-Islamist, non-theocratic, but at the end of the day, his rule over the past many years has been basically kowtowing to the Islamists, pushing anti-American conspiracy theories. And while Pakistan might strategically be an ally militarily, realistically, ideologically, they're not. And they have, that's why Osama bin Laden was hiding there. That's why when we did an operation to get him, we couldn't even tell the Pakistani government we were going to do so. So if you're going to continue, at the end of the day, yes, we need to pull out military operations in general, but we haven't lost a soldier in Afghanistan to the Taliban in the last 18 months. So to call that a never-ending war is basically propaganda of folks who really want to just sort of upend what we're doing for political points when we had strategic positioning in a country right next to Iran, right next to Pakistan. These areas are continuing to be high threats for ideological cells that can build themselves. And what we need, I think, if there's any lessons we can get out of what's happening now, is maybe America will open our eyes to the fact that, yes, there's no military strategy to defeat the Islamist ascendancy, but boy, we need to get going on the Cold War against political Islam, because it is growing in Iran, Syria, Afghanistan, and across the planet.
Is that the fundamental mistake that we've made? I mean, not just the last 20 years and the last four presidents, but going back to our support of the Mujahideen in the 80s, you know, the Charlie Wilson's War, as it's sort of known, by the great book, not a very good movie, by the way. But is that it, that we haven't confronted the ideology? We've looked at it strictly through the lens of the military?
I cannot underscore that enough. That's been my testimony to Congress when I testified to the Senate in 18. I said, what's this countering violent extremism? Come on, you guys, get a spine. It's countering Islamism. But they were so worried about free speech and Islamophobia and all these other constructs of Islamists that prevent us from countering the real threat, the real war that's happening between. I mean, it's not a surprise that the Ilhan Omars of the world this week are giddy. She's not complaining about the loss of women's rights in Afghanistan on her Twitter feed the last few days. No, it's all about anti-Americanism. It's about getting us out of their way so Islamists from Turkey to Qatar to Iran can ascend. And, you know, yes, it's a failed state, but we, you know, the fact that for so long, remember the Iranian approach of Obama was, oh, we have to work with the moderate presidents, et cetera. Now they just elected the hanging judge to become their president, in which there's been a complete confluence. There's no such thing as a moderate Islamist. These are basically smokescreens to have the left think that somehow, you know, a nonviolent Islamist is better than a violent Islamist. And they're drinking from the same hookah, or smoking from the same hookah, if you will, which is about the fact that everything's to blame on the West, while Islamism, Islamic State concepts are going to ascend. And the way to defeat that is to work with groups like our Muslim Reform Movement that believes in secular democracy, that wants to separate mosque and state. There's so many women that are fighting for this, and men that believe in freedom and want to counter the yoke of Islamic theocracy, no different than what our founding fathers did in America against theocracy. But so far, it seems that the establishment in America just wants to look at us as a military target and then leave immediately on a dime, rather than have any long-term growth in a Cold War concept, an information war, if you will, against political Islam.
Well, we have military bases around the world. Why not have one there in Kabul?
Exactly. Now, you know, listen, I get the difference with, there are comparisons to Germany and Korea and Japan where we have bases. But first of all, I remind folks, we completely defeated those countries in a massive conflict and a massive war. We did not necessarily go in and completely defeat Afghanistan. Yes, we defeated the Taliban. But the other thing is Afghanistan is an ally, but it's a failed state. Having said that, we have bases around the world because we're able to, with intelligence, with operations, fight conflicts there before they set up shop and then bring it here. Remember, Afghanistan was not, as we come on the 20th anniversary, we have since had 7-7 in 2005. We had Fort Hood in 2009. We had ISIS operations in Charlie Hebdo in 2015. We had numbers of attacks that have continued in the West and are going to continue. Austria, just a few months ago, because of an attack in their country, declared political Islam to be an ideology they were going to prevent from spreading, which, by the way, I find to be foolhardy. That's not how you defeat bad ideas, by making them illegal. But bottom line is we are in knee-deep into a conflict that isn't going to go away by just pulling troops out of Afghanistan. And a few thousand troops there, I mean, when we pulled a few hundred or a thousand troops out of Syria that we did a year ago, the Turks went in and slaughtered the Kurds. And that was prevented by a few hundred troops. And yes, we weren't there to fight wars. That's not why our troops are there. But we are feared. And now that's not going to happen anymore. We are no longer feared.
Speaking of that, how damaging will it be? I mean, in addition to just the moral damage, but the geopolitical damage, if we do not provide safe haven, if we do not get all of those translators and other Afghan people who helped us, helped our troops, but were on America's side during the fighting with the Taliban over the last 20 years, if we do not get them out, if they're slaughtered by the Taliban, what would the implications of that be for the Islamic world as they view America?
The same implications as we see now, as the world sees folks who really have no ideological love for America flowing across our borders. And yet we have folks that have been working hand in hand with our military to keep America secure, who fly American flags on their door, that have been working with us, that now we sort of let hang off a cargo plane that takes off and die from that because we aren't supporting them. Yes, we need to bring them back and give them safe haven because we owe that. We can't betray them. And it'll be used on Al Jazeera. It'll be used on press TV out of Iran, Syrian TV, Russian TV. This stuff will be pressed all over that America will abandon you and serve its own interests. And my family saw America as a liberator. Our military, the reason I served in the military 11 years was my parents taught me that the Syrian military, the Iranian military was evil. The American military is a force of good. It's there to help people. When I served on the USS El Paso, we went to Somalia to take food to try to help them. It was a force of good. It wasn't a colonial imperialist adventure at all. Now, the Islamists try to paint us that way, and these images and the folks that we abandon are not going to look to us in the future to be helping them, because they're going to say, well, they might help us now, but boy, would the political winds bring in a Biden who's a Carter 2.0 or Obama 3.0, you're going to end up seeing them depart. So maybe we better find some other way to work.
He is Dr. Zudi Jasser. He's the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, former U.S. Navy lieutenant commander, as he was describing, and pick up the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Dr. Jasser, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Wednesday, August 25th, you'll want to mark this down, 6:30 to 7:30, the next installment of the Black Light Speaker Series at Loyola University.
Oh, it's back?
The featured speaker is Alicia Raines, who is a master's in education in 2016. Oh, you know, this is going to be good. She's going to discuss the topic of white supremacy at work and how, without being tamed, it can undermine your company's DIE plans. Diversity, inclusion, equity.
Okay.
White supremacy in the workplace and how to combat it. Wednesday, August 25th, 6:30 to 7:30, Black Light Speaker Series at that fine Jesuit institution where I earned my law degree, Loyola University. Mm-hmm. That's a big problem where you work, white supremacists. A lot of guys walking around in hoods there. I mean, I know you don't need to wear a hood to be a white supremacist, but is that a problem that comes up a lot in your daily interaction with colleagues? We have a real white supremacy problem downtown at the corporate office.
Oh, right. Yeah. So we better bring a speaker in to, so we can right our wrongs. I mean, are you 312-642-5600, turnkey top pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
White supremacy culture in the workplace and how to combat it. How many people work for a company that has either in the leadership or even in the ranks significant identifiable number of white supremacists?
Don't look at me.
No, I mean.
I'm
not saying that.
What a colossal waste of money. I wonder how much she's getting paid for this.
I'm not saying that racists don't exist and racism doesn't exist. What I am saying is the idea that there's a real problem in corporate America.
It's systemic racism.
With white supremacists in charge. I mean, that word almost doesn't mean anything anymore because, you know, if you don't use, if you inadvertently use something they consider a dog whistle, now you're a white supremacist. You're advancing white supremacy. Frankly,
you're going to get fired and your life is going to be destroyed.
Frankly, your existence as a white person and the privilege that is attached, that, I guess, is one example of perpetuating white supremacy in and of itself. So it's just every day your presence is promoting white supremacy. I guess if you want to make that argument, please do. She plans to discuss
a good laugh.
The tenets of white supremacy and what it looks like. I can't wait. Hear what it looks like. How to combat white supremacy in the workplace.
Do you have a picture of the lady right there?
Oh. Yeah, Alicia Raines. Uh-huh. White supremacy and in the workplace, how to combat it. How about white supremacy in education? Obviously, it didn't stop you from getting a master's degree in education, Ms. Raines. This is the conversation we had about Ken Chenault, the former CEO of American Express yesterday, who, when he was elevated to the position of CEO and what it meant to be one of the few Black Americans as CEOs of a Fortune 100 company. I hope it'll be judged on the merits of me as a businessman, as an executive, rather than on my skin color. That was implicit in his comment. Today, it's all about skin color and dye programs for Ken Chenault. What happened? So Joe Epstein has a good piece in the Wall Street Journal on this. And it's a topic we've covered before, but perhaps a refresher. The difference between integration and Black power. And this turns out to be a real important distinction. Because integration not only been put on the back burner, now we have people openly promoting implementing segregation. We talked about it last week.
The Atlanta
grade school that literally has separate classes for Black and white kids.
Yeah, the Black teachers with the Black kids, white teachers with the white kids.
And the white supremacist there is a Black woman who's the principal being sued by one of the Black parents who's got a student at the school who can't believe that you literally have
segregation.
Pre-Brown v. Board schooling in Atlanta. That's what's happening. Epstein uses Noah Lyles to illustrate his point. Noah Lyles, you may remember, a medalist in the recently concluded Olympic Games. He won a bronze medal in the 200 meter. He did an interview with Lester Holt about the Games and about America and representing America in the Games. And this is what Noah Lyles had to say.
Is it fair to say you were in depression?
It probably wasn't until really the Black Lives Matter movement started gaining a lot of traction. That's really when the depression kind of just took over. You're hearing on the news every day that you're not wanted. And as an athlete who's trying to go to the Olympics and representing the U.S., you know, you love your country, but it hurts even more to see that the country that you want to support so much is trying to kill you. And it's really hard to get through that.
Oh, that poor soul.
The country that you love so much is trying to kill you. Who's trying to kill Noah Lyles? Joe Epstein writing, that sad moment caused a wave of depression of my own. Interesting, is it not, that this is how the Black Lives Matter movement translates itself into the mind of a sensitive, athletically successful and likable young man such as Mr. Lyles. Is Mr. Lyles misreading the BLM message? Do Americans really not want Lyles and his associates in the country? How has it come about that he came to believe such bilge?
Right. Like, what led him to that?
Well, you know, this is where...
You think people are trying to come and kill you?
We don't want Noah Lyles representing us on the Olympic team. Who said that? Who believes that?
Yeah.
This is like trying to find those white supremacist CEOs of in corporate America that Alicia Reynes is after.
Well, it's like he's creating unnecessary suffering.
But where does it come from? It comes from the messaging. You love your country, but it hurts even more to see the country that you want to support is trying to kill you. Also, you know, sort of it's this systemic sort of newspeak, too. The country is trying to kill you because the country is white supremacist and the culture is...
Because of Trump.
Intended to marginalize, if not eliminate, according to him, Black Americans. Yeah. Epstein points out that it's a bit different, the Black Lives Matter, neo-Marxist, the messaging there, the anger, as compared to, say, the messaging of Roy Wilkins or Martin Luther King Jr., Whitney Young, Bayard Rustin, as he describes them appropriately, men who were on the front lines when it was truly dangerous to be there. So he asks, why hasn't a stronger Black leadership arisen since the earlier generation of brave and highly intelligent men? How did not only Black Lives Matter, but the Civil Rights Movement generally skitter so far off the track to end up having a young Black athlete's lifelong desire to run the Olympics marred by his belief that his countrymen wish to kill him? And again, this choice between integration and Black power. And it's you can use this with any racial demographic, integration and fairness across all institutions, or it's power based on my racial identity and I get to impose my will via those institutions on people who don't look like me. So this is the argument again of Shelby and Eli Steele and many others that the Black Lives Matter, the identitarian politics is just a new racial order. They won't go so far as to say it's the new Jim Crow because it's not as a violent and oppressive as the Jim Crow laws were yet. But it is a new racial order. It's the same thing. I mean, this goes back. Frederick Douglass talked about this, for goodness sakes. This is the government conferring benefits and imposing responsibilities based on race. This is what they want, and they're angry about it. And they understand their righteous indignation, whether it's real or performative, is the path to power. And then you get, so all you have to do is have like seminars at Loyola prattling on about white supremacy and you're advancing the flag to power, status. And you get corporate America to fold in. You get faith-based institutions to fold in. You have the power of the state now folding in significant fashion. Now you're cooking with fire. Maurice and Berwyn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, something to just overcorrection. My parents are from Mississippi. They're almost 80 years old. I know what racism is. The word racism is overused. Racism is, hey, nutmeg, almost let it slip, I'm going to hang you from that tree. I knew what Strange Fruit was before the movie came out about the song Strange Fruit. Take out the word racism and just use the word disturbing. I am a manager in a pretty prominent hospital system where I actually supervise some people who attended your lovely high school. And so I find it disturbing that I'm one of three managers in a very large hospital system. It's disturbing to me that I'm one of three African Americans. Is it racist? No, but it does disturb me. As I told your screener, it's disturbing to me that African Americans make up 13% of the population. Surprise, surprise. But we have a 34% incarceration rate. I find that disturbing. Is it racism? Maybe a little bit. But those buzzwords is why we're constantly at each other's throats. And the Democrats and the fear-mongering, I'm not a big fan of it. Your guys do it a little bit here and there, or sometimes a lot. But it's a lot of overcorrection. But at some point, you may have to validate something's going on.
Well,
fair point?
Yeah, but so, let me just get to the fundamental here. I mean, does Joe Epstein and others? It's not a new argument, but it's an important one. Does he have it right when he says there is essentially two approaches here, and it's we're talking black white, but it doesn't need to be limited to this. It's unique black white because of the history of black Americans here and slavery and Jim Crow, of course. But it's integration or it's a power grab by racial identity. That's the choice.
I got to be honest with you. I'm so tired about people talking about me being black. A friend of mine says it the best way. He wants to be treated like Larry David treats everyone. You know.
Yeah, right.
You know, he thinks the world should be like Larry. It should be remade like Larry David, where he just hates everyone.
Yes.
You know, I could care. I think if I never heard so much about being black in my life, my goodness. I get it. I'm black. I'm like Steve Martin, the jerk.
Right.
You know?
Right. No, I get it. I get it. But that's the point. No, and I'm all for a Curb Your Enthusiasm world. I'm all for it. Sign me up. But that's the point.
I don't need it pushed into my face constantly. I would like certain things to be recognized, like the incarceration rate. One thing your guy did, he changed the crack cocaine laws. It, unfortunately, you know, he shot himself in the foot a few other times. But I don't use the word fair. I want things to be equal.
Well,
but a lot of things that come up are overcorrection for past deeds. But you can't go backwards.
Well, equal.
And that's
equal.
No, there's no white supremacy in corporate America. There's some maybe imbalances.
Yeah, equal on the front end, not the back end. Equal on the
Correct.
Front end. Okay. Hey, so what about this? What about this? What about this Olympic sprinter, Noah? What's his name? Noah Lyle, right? Noah Lyles. And what he said, like, my country's trying to kill me. Where does that come from?
Well, I think you said that. You used the term that I used together.
Oh,
we lost Maurice. He was just about to agree with
If you live in a world where you're watching TV. Hey, you, like I have, you have spent the summer watching where I had to watch on TV people debate if someone who looks like me should be allowed to breathe for 9 minutes. You can get into the weeds about it or not. You watched on TV where someone who looks like you was jogging down the street and then two people who did not look like you shot them. If you don't ever see an opposite viewpoint, you will assume that. And I always tell you guys have missed the mark so many times on being the people who say, hey, all conservatives are not like those guys.
Right. Well,
not all white people are trying to kill black people. Of course not. It's not
right.
The purge.
Right, but how did he get to that point?
Yeah, but also, like, you know, like, how do we miss the mark if we're just sort of presenting our view and saying that is not representative of all police? Obviously, it's not representative of all white people and so on and so forth. I mean, all we can do is say it and live it, and what else are we supposed to do?
Well, here's the thing. It's the work of the good to combat the work of the evil. All cops are not bad, but where are the good cops to speak out about the bad cops?
Yeah, there were a lot that did about Chauvin.
Correct. Same thing about, and I don't mean, and I hate the thing about, oh my God, I'm white, and I have to apologize. Don't apologize for being white. Your white skin is beautiful, man. Amy, your white skin is beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hey.
I can go on. Thank you.
It is. All skin is beautiful. But when you're wrapped up in this cocoon of all the social media is the fear mongering. And that's the sad thing. This is a great country that has a lot of flaws, but we're so divided and we get stuck in our bubble.
All right. Thanks for the call, Maurice, as always. Always appreciate Maurice's reviews on this. But I think you need to think about that. And this is part of the pushback, too. If you have a chance to talk to reasonable people of different races like Maurice, like we do here, and say, is that what you want? Is this about black power versus white power? Or do we want fairness across institutions regardless of race? These are, when you boil it down, it's not that complicated.
No.
These choices and these conversations are not that complicated. You just have to sort of wade through the Chardonnay Antifa and the hate has no home here mafia in your neighborhood, and then you can get to reasonable people and find some, you know, reasonable approaches to how we all live together famously.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when.
You're moving out.
Bum, bum. That means it's time to have our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, Inc., wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Check them out. They do a lot of good work, economic analysis in particular, but policy analysis, including the areas of COVID. And so maybe Ted can answer this riddle for me. If Dr. Allison Owardi, one of the officially licensed Rona busters, said that 400 new cases a day was a, quote, line in the sand for us, particularly around major things like planning to open one of the largest school districts in the country a year ago, and they didn't open CPS because 400 cases a day, then why, now that we're at 400 cases a day in Chicago again with Delta, should CPS open the schools this time
around? Don't give anybody any ideas.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the metrics. 400 was a line in the sand, said Dr. Owardi a year ago. Why is it not a line in the sand now, Ted?
Well, hey, good morning, guys. Hey, Amy, you don't have to worry about Dan giving them any ideas. They got their ideas on their own. I mean, they're quick to those kind of facts, to, you know, CTU to,
okay,
to grab onto that stuff. Look, you know, we're back to the same discussion as before, and I was looking at the data this morning. It's, you know, it's always cases, cases, cases. And, you know, a year and a half later, here we are back to cases, cases, cases. Well, cases don't matter anymore right now.
They don't matter at all.
At all. And you know, so many of the cases now are asymptomatic.
Well, we're testing healthy children. That's the problem.
Well, and that's a big part of it. And so, you know, what really matters here is hospitalizations and deaths. We're back to the same. I mean, didn't we have this discussion a year and a half ago? And that's what really matters. And if you look at it, you know, look, let me say one thing, because, you know, I've been talking about this a lot and researching it a lot, is, you know, what's happening to kids, because that's what really matters right now. You know, as we've talked about, the elderly are largely vaccinated, and you know, those who want to be are. So we got to really be careful with the kids. That's our risk. And, you know, when we look at this, I'm struggling to find, with exception of more hospitalizations, struggling to find, like, you know, any increase in deaths. We had one in Illinois for young kids, but none in Florida in the last couple of weeks, none that I can see in Texas. So despite all the noise and all the increase in cases, it looks like things are okay, and we're seeing a big collapse in deaths, collapse in Florida, even though cases are still high. So hopefully we're getting past this.
It's a collapse of hospitalizations, though, in Chicago. I mean, at the peak last year, the first wave, Ted, 160 hospitalized. Then the second wave, November, December, at University of Chicago, I'm talking, 100. And right now they have 19. And the doctor I spoke with there said, and we're getting them in and out, and there's nobody in the ICU right now on because of COVID. They may have with COVID, but not because of COVID.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, too, is that the wave is different now. You got maybe more people sick. Maybe, you know, we know that the Delta has
has been more contagious, so you're going to have more people get it. But given the fact that the people who are vaccinated, we're going to have people more in and out. And so hopefully this is just the waves get smaller, less dangerous, and we just keep fighting through it.
Well, that's what's happened over the last 18 months. Not that anybody notices amid all of the hysteria and histrionics. Keith Peacow, the mayor of Orland Park, had a good analogy when he gave his briefing at the last board meeting. And what we've seen in terms of 7-day rolling averages of death is a continued decline with each one of these spikes. And the spikes is a little less of a spike over the last year and a half. They've been about four. And it's like a bouncing ball, you know. The trajectory of the entropy is down. And it's the same thing with the virus that's punching itself out.
Well, yeah, and what really ticks me off about it all is that the media is still playing the game of using the new data in, you know, to scare people, right? And so I just saw a Shaw Media report that says, COVID-19 cases in young Illinois children have increased almost 1,500%, right? 1,500% in the last 6 weeks. You put that on a headline, and that's enough to scare people. But then you got to look at the facts, and you get a totally different story.
So, do we know how many Illinois kids are even hospitalized right now with COVID?
We've got a FOIA in right now, waiting to hear back, because we couldn't parse the data from what we have here. It's hard to know. What we do know is the CDC is reporting the deaths, and we're on the 0 to 17. We've had 11 deaths according to the CDC. It was 10 before, so we've increased one. Again, every one of those is really sad, but what we're seeing is that the kids are, again, able to withstand this with no problems, except for maybe a few of those that are comorbid. So the good news, it's really good news, and I look at that for Florida and others. Florida has not had an increase in death in the last couple weeks, despite the numbers they've had there. Texas has not either. So I look at that as very good news. I keep watching it to be careful. We don't want to get it wrong, but I can't find evidence, despite the increased hospitalizations, that this is going to be a bad way for kids.
Well, if CPS does open, they are going to have 2,000 new employees. 2,000 new employees.
I get one today.
Have been hired by CPS because they're flush. At the same time, there's projections that there will be 100,000 fewer students in the Chicago public school system than there was pre-COVID.
I mean, that is fantastic, right? Fantastic craziness in terms of numbers. And if you guys will recall, when Lightfoot was negotiating this new contract with CTU, whatever that was, right before COVID, they were paying massive increases for all kinds of new employees. The numbers were huge over the next 5 years, and it also included new employees. So they were already planning for that even before COVID. But now with the nearly $2 billion coming from the federal government for COVID, they're flush, as you say, and they can do whatever they want, regardless of whether this school district is shrinking or not. And we know it is.
Well, and are they going door to door looking for those lost kids, trying to find them, making phone calls?
Well, what they need, and this is the way it works in funding and education, is they make a count of how many kids are in the classroom on certain days, and that determines how much money the state gives Chicago for education. So they're going to be knocking on doors trying to make sure that they get the enrollment numbers as high as possible, because they need to justify these increases at some point. At some point, people figure out, and they're figuring out that the school district is shrinking while the spending continues to skyrocket.
Well, right. I mean, the hot suburban housing market, what do you think that's a function of? It's people leaving the city to go to schools in the suburbs, or leaving the state to go to school, send their kids to school in other states, most notably Florida. So, I mean, where are the missing kids? Well, a lot of the parents are making different educational choices for their kids. That's where they are.
Oh, absolutely, and you'll see it across the board, which kind of leads to that whole census discussion of an increase in Chicago population according to the census. It's one of those, again, where you just don't know what to trust anymore, because we know that Governor Pritzker spent over something like $50 million to get out the census count. And God knows, what we know is that 2020 census process is very different from the one in 2010, and they could have grabbed many more people that otherwise. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison is what I'm saying. They spent a lot of money to get a count, and it increases the Chicago population by 50,000. But you got to wonder how that squares up with everything else we know.
Those rabble-rousers, the Edgar County watchdogs, are at it again. They FOIA'd the Illinois State Board of Education's compliance audit. And, quite a list of findings. I think you know, you read more audit reports than I do, but more than the sort of typical stuff you'll get back in a compliance audit from the auditor, this sounds like an agency that is not particularly well run, including on things like after ISBE, the Illinois State Board of Education, informed of their failure to properly report felony convictions to the TRS and the retirement fund for the city of Chicago. I mean, little things like that that were found in the compliance audit.
Yeah, what's a few pensions? What's a few felonies in among friends?
I mean, if we can't provide state taxpayer funded pensions for felons, who can we provide them for, Ted?
No, it's a long list. I think Edgar County Watchdogs did a good job on this and just bringing it to life because, you know, who wants to read audit reports, right? I mean, that's like the last thing anybody wants to do. But, you know, ISBE's an interesting monster because it's a state board of education. You know, you could argue whether we actually need one or not. You know, they're the ones that help bring critical race theory into the schools and into the training of teachers and all that. And here we are again looking at, you know, that's what they're focused on, and maybe they should just be based on this audit list, and it's a long one, of focusing how to run what they do better. But, you know, I was just looking at the report card, Illinois report card. Not even a third of Illinois kids meet or exceed reading standards. And maybe that's something worthwhile for them to focus on.
You mentioned, too, the census, and we find that, and I was just mentioning about the suburban housing market, so let's talk a little bit about that. Let's fold in the suburbs here. Less anybody in the suburbs because of this temporary spike in the housing market think something important in a good way is happening in the suburbs. It's just a transfer of people. It's not that the suburbs are growing. The census data indicating very few new homes actually added in suburban Chicago communities, which just tells you, you know, somebody goes out the door, somebody backfills them, somebody goes out the door and somebody backfills them, like oftentimes from Chicago, maybe another suburb as well. But it's a transfer of people as we're continuing to see an exodus. It's not an inflow of people mitigating the exodus.
Yeah, I mean, I think what people need to understand is in Illinois, it's a net transfer out, right? That's the starting point. We shrink. We are shrinking, and that's I think there's no doubt about that. Even with the push to increase the count of the census in 2020, we still shrank.
Well, I mean, 87 of 102 counties lost population in the last decade. How could you not be shrinking?
That's right. I mean, you know, unless Chicago became a massive magnet again, and that's not happening now. So when you get back to the suburbs, yeah, lucky that they're picking up some of the Chicago people. But, you know, what we saw was the slowest growth in a long, long time in these suburbs, where, you know, they've been growing at, you know, 8% rates every decade or something like that, some big number. Now it was down to 1.4%. So it's getting very dangerous levels where, you know, it's one thing for Peoria and Decatur and others to shrink. It's going to be another once our suburbs start shrinking. Then it gets really scary.
What do you think about the idea? I mean, this is on the pension beat, and I know this is something that I guess apparently is only interesting to a handful of wonks and people who fashion themselves civic leaders, who often are not. But what do you think about backdoor increasing the contribution of public sector employees by taxing only public pensions in Illinois? Taxing public pension income. So you get your guaranteed benefit plan and you get your payout, but we're going to backdoor increase your contribution by 5% by taxing it.
Well, you know, here's the problem. I don't like any tax increase in Illinois right now.
Well, neither do I, but
because it just you know takes more money, gives more money to the politicians to avoid fixing the problem. So now, you know, I'm all for taxing the pensions, but then what I'd like to see is a revenue neutral thing where we lower the tax rate on everybody else, and that's why I think it'd be fair. We tax pensions like most states do, but whatever money we get from that, give it as a reduction to everybody else in a lower rate. But just to give the politicians a way out to tax to do something, we know that here it's a lie because whatever we give them, they'll just misuse or misspend or leverage to their favor, and that's my concern.
And you can't lockbox it because money's fungible, so they'll just play the shell game they play with money if you tried to lockbox it, I suppose.
Yeah, or, you know, okay, pensions are better funded now, so we can give out slightly higher benefits again or slightly bigger raises. This is why we can't win this thing. Every time we try to do something good, you know, they can just turn around and give that money away with higher raises. You see what's going to happen with the new contracts. They're always bigger. They're always better.
Right.
So we can't get away from it. The only way to do it is to end pensions. You know, taxing taxing pensioners is just one more way to perpetuate the pension plan. And that's what we don't need to perpetuate the plan. We need to end it and move to 401ks now.
Ted Dabrowski, president at wirepoints.org. Ted, always good to have you. Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The reason government, one of the reasons government continues to expand uninterrupted, no matter performance, no matter sector or program, is because every piece of legislation signed that includes more spending or a new program is reported as helping someone get something. It's always an unalloyed good, whatever the government is doing. So think about this in the context of the Green New Deal 1.0, which the politicians call the infrastructure, $1.2 trillion in infrastructure spending. That's what they call it. America's roads and bridges. And of course, there's no institutional memory. There's no recall. There's no, gosh, have we been here before? We've been here many times before. How did it work out the last time we went for this pitch? About as well as it worked when Springfield was poised to buy the monorail from the Phil Hartman Music Man character. So Kevin Lewis points us to this study out. Kevin Lewis, who's a Boston Globe columnist and an MIT physicist, if I'm recalling correctly. A paper by a member of the St. Louis Fed, board member at the St. Louis Fed, looking at the shovel-ready Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which provided $28 billion to state governments for improving, say it with me, roads and bridges, shovel-ready projects, $28 billion, 2009. What did we find after people stop paying attention? How much money are we going to distribute? $28 billion. We're going to rebuild roads and bridges. That's the press release. Stop thinking. Pay no attention. Never connect the inputs to the outputs. Well, you've got some economists who do so. And it's quite interesting, the things they find. They're rather instructive for not repeating the same mistakes, if anybody would care to pay attention. The number of structurally deficient or functionally obsolete bridges was nearly unchanged. The number of workers on highway and bridge construction did not significantly increase. The annual value of construction put in place for public highways barely budged. The researcher here demonstrates that Recovery Act highway grants, as governments spent the highway grant money, many did what? Same thing we were talking about with Ted Dabrowski. Oh, I'm getting money over here dedicated to this project. Well, then I'll take it from the money I had dedicated to that project and I'll spend it elsewhere and we'll grow the pie of spending. Shrink the pie of money you get to keep since it's all your money. So what happened? As states and localities got highway grants, the quote-unquote infrastructure grants, they slashed their own contributions to highway infrastructure to free up state dollars, local dollars, for other uses. The researcher here, the state's receipt of Recovery Act highway dollars had no statistically significant causal impact on that state's total highway spending. Thus, the amount of actual highway infrastructure investment following the act's passage was likely to be very similar to that under a no-stimulus counterfactual. We just spent $28 billion. They took $28 billion collectively is going to go to roads and bridges. Okay, well, then we'll repurpose the collective $28 billion to expand other state programs. The last thing we're going to do is reduce our mission, conserve our resources. We're not going to do that. And so that was $28 billion then. in a, what was it, $700 or $800 billion package. So now you'll see the same thing in 2021 if Nancy Pelosi lets it go through the House. It'll just be a little bit bigger. And that's how government grows. And that's how 19 Senate Republicans sign on. Because who's against roads and bridges? And that sophistry sells. It's sad. For more on this and other matters, we're pleased to be joined by Joachim Buch, visiting scholar at the American Institute for Economic Research. Joachim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you guys. Always entertaining.
We try. So just comment. We have just attempted to throw it collectively. $4.7 trillion against the wall to see if anything sticks in the last couple of weeks. Yeah. That's significant. And how do Republicans and Democrats get away from this? More or less, I think, like I said, but I get your reaction as well.
Yeah, I like this. It wasn't too long ago that we were talking about government spending in the billions, like you mentioned, in 2008 and so. And now we're talking about the government spending in the trillions, and nothing has really changed, right? Like, it's the same old game. It's the same old, waving of the emergency of something that really has to be done right now, and then spend as much money as you possibly can. Sure enough, the U.S. economy is bigger than it was in 2008, and there are slightly more people, but it's not like it's not a factor of 1,000, right, from billion to trillion. This is just how government operates.
Well, even when it shrinks, we were just talking about this with another guest in the last hour. Even when it shrinks, as say 100,000 students leave the Chicago public school system, the budget increased, the hiring increased. They're hiring 2,000 more employees for 100,000 fewer students. So, I mean, this is just the growth of the individuals you're serving is almost irrelevant to those in charge in terms of the expansion of what they control.
Yeah, I mean, this is isn't new either, right? Like, if a government department doesn't spend all of its money, it gets its budget cut for the next year, right? So there's always an incentive for government officials to spend as much as possible and max out their budgets and always claim that they don't have enough resources to do what they're supposed to be doing. And I always find that curious, you know, like politicians are always screaming about reform. We need to reform this. We need to fix our broken this. And it's always the areas that they're in charge of. It's like, why do you guys need to reform something that ostensibly is your responsibility and was your responsibility 10 years ago and was your responsibility 5 years ago? And still, you're not either neglecting to do what you're supposed to be doing or you're inventing reasons to do it. Like, this is madness.
And you wrote about sort of a similar dynamic that's at play with COVID response, the race to win COVID infinity. But anyway, I like the portmanteau there. This is what they do with our liberty as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to be funny with COVID and infinity there. I don't know if it worked out so well.
It's pretty good.
So this is the thing with emergencies and governments doing something very quickly and very on a large scale like this. It's fast enough to be unique, but it's slow enough for people to sort of sleepwalk into it and forget your past, you know? So I remember in the beginning of the pandemic, it was like all the reasons for why government had to do the things that they did were very clear. You know, we had to like flatten the curve for the hospitals, and we need to make sure that, you know, our hospital systems didn't get overrun 2 weeks for the NHS in the UK and things, right? Stuff like that. And then if you look back over what happened over the summer last year, over the fall last year, in the winter of last year, and then the spring this year, we've just shifted the entire narrative, just shifted the goalposts. It isn't about the hospitals anymore. Back last spring, it was, you know, we just need to hold out for a little bit before we have vaccines, right? And then when we have vaccines, and like even for countries that have, you know, 70-80% of their population vaccinated, and basically can't get much higher than that. And they're still saying, no, this is unique, and we need to shut down societies and prevent everybody from doing what they want to do because this is so dangerous. And like, hang on a second, not more than a year ago, you guys were saying we're doing this for emergency reasons right now, only briefly until everyone's vaccinated. Now everybody is, and you're still doing it. Like, you just shifted the goalpost the entire way. And you just, like, you know, the problem got smaller and smaller, but you kept using the exact same tool and the exact same solution. for the problem that you imagine. This is crazy.
Yeah, and here in Illinois, our governor has signed 19 months in a row, an emergency order, and we don't have a public health emergency right now. Our hospitalizations are excellent. Our death rate from this is the lowest it's been since this entire thing began. But why do you think they're keeping it going? Why are they pushing a narrative rather than the science and the data?
Oh, wow, science. If you want to be cynical about this, I don't think the numbers that you just mentioned matter. It's like nobody
cares. They don't matter.
Or at least not if you're, at least not if you're in policy making or if you're in politics or being a health czar. But you don't really, like, you're grasping at straws to maintain the power that you're so high on using right now, and you want to keep going for as long as you possibly can.
Yeah.
And to some extent, we don't have to be conspiratorial here and think that these people are particularly evil. Like, I think this is just an outcome of what happens if you're hyper-focused on one thing. You don't really pay any price for being wrong or pay for your mistakes or have consequences when you do something wrong. And you're just like looking at this one thing without raising your gaze and seeing what else it does to society.
It's just unbounded, and there's no account. There's no self accountability, and those are character flaws.
Absolutely.
You may have good intentions. I really don't care. You've got major character flaws. And another example of this too, what you were speaking about, and what Amy was speaking about, these statistics. Now think about it the other way. Alex Berenson had a good write up at his Substack, and he's got all kinds of screenshots, headlines, New York Times. From February of this year, when could the United States reach herd immunity? It's complicated, but they ultimately come down. We could reach herd immunity threshold by May if we can increase the pace of vaccinations to 3 million shots per day. Well, that was reached shortly after this was published, and we're well past May, and the concept of herd immunity is even discussed. In fact, they purposely mislead the public on this topic by talking about 90 million Americans who are unvaccinated and with no consideration to the number of people who have natural immunity, who have been infected and survived the infection, you know, like the 99.8% of other people who were infected and survived and now have immunity that's as strong or stronger than the vaccinations. That's not included. So it's not just moving the goalposts. It's not just forget what we said yesterday or a month ago or 3 months ago. It's we're not going to tell you the whole story, and then it becomes purposeful. If you're not going to give me context, then there is something ulterior and, frankly, less than redeeming. The good intention default evaporates.
Yeah, I agree with you that I probably don't think most of these people in charge have good intentions deep down. They're very good at playing a role, House of Cards style.
Yeah, right.
They do have good intentions, but I don't think they really do. But even so, like you also said, I would rather like analyze what people are saying on the presumption that they are serious and are genuine. Like, at least give them a break. But even when you do that, it doesn't make sense. Like, you're just shifting the goalposts, you're inventing new stories, you're changing government official doctrine on no change of underlying information or evidence at all. In everything from masks to like the effectiveness of lockdowns to vaccines and things like that. I for the life of me, I can't understand how we as societies let them, how we sleepwalked into a situation like this. Like 2 years ago, right? If somebody proposed this to anybody, it's like, oh yeah, the Western world is going to lock down like an authoritarian nation and do this and that and restrict people's liberties. People would laugh at you. Like, no, of course not. We're a good, free, democratic society. We have rights. That's never going to happen. Nobody's going to allow them. We'd have pitchforks on the street. No, we don't. And people want this. You know, The Economist ran a survey asking a bunch of people in the UK what policies they wanted enacted after the pandemic had ended. And they asked them, like, you know, do you want, like, until we have it under control or until there are no more COVID or permanently, even if COVID is extinct? And, you know, the numbers are just crazy. It's like almost half the respondents want to have proof of vaccination even after COVID for all kind of foreign travel. Something like a third of people want casinos and nightclubs permanently closed and 10 p.m. curfews for everything. It's like,
yeah, well,
we have a third of people in the UK are complete autocrats.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look,
well, look at Australia.
Well, how about look at New Zealand today?
New
Zealand is locking down. It was today, again, one case.
They locked down for one case?
One case in New Zealand, and they're on lockdown. So we know and so you're right about the autocratic impulses of the constituents that drive the autocratic impulses of the politicians. But I wonder, too, since you're a native of Sweden, you know, so you and Amy can talk Swedish for this part if you want. But I mean, you know, it's the handle on Sweden is there's more of a trust relationship between the government and the citizen. And this is why Sweden could take a light touch. They have more faith in the decision making of their citizens. Is that what distinguishes Sweden from the United States in terms of how the two countries have respectively approached this?
No, I've written about this a lot, and there's a lot more than that that differs the U.S. from Sweden. But to make the issue even clearer, Sweden has had initially, at least, a very different approach than its neighboring countries, Denmark and Norway or Finland. And those countries share most of the same like cultural or public policy traits that we would consider, you know, trust in authorities, like stable welfare state, high taxes, the Nordic ideal, right? So there is clearly something else going on in how Sweden operated, and I think basically and it's also become a myth by now. So by the time basically the international media caught up and realized that Sweden was not doing what the rest of the world was doing, Sweden started to change. I think December last year, they started to invoke the same kind of lockdowns and restrictions that Denmark and Norway and other countries had done. And there isn't that much of a difference between Sweden and its neighboring countries anymore. But international media has sort of shifted again. And like first Sweden was this horrible place that just, you know, sacrificed its elderly. And now it's, you know, just like a light touch kind of approach. And I don't hear that much about Sweden internationally anymore. Whereas Sweden had become normal again. It's like, I don't know, it's upside down in how most of international media has been treating Sweden. But to your actual question, I think that there's a lot of things differing between like the Nordic countries and the U.S., but we don't really see it in outcomes. Like, even though demographics and culture and trust and authorities are completely different, we see very similar outcomes.
Joachim Buch, visiting scholar at the American Institute for Economic Research. Joachim, thanks for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Toximica, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'd rather have my kids' intellectual, social, and mental development hindered than be called a racist. I'd rather go along with my corporate culture, allow my career path to be limited, than be called a racist. So I'll just go along. Now I'd rather have the quality of health care that I have access to be degraded than be called a racist. Okay. It's funny. We laugh about it when stories like this one, the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, which I am a member.
Of course. You're a leche lady, aren't you?
Urged the use of gender-inclusive language such as chest feeding, parents' milk, and human milk feeding in new guidelines because the ABM recognizes that not all people who give birth and lactate identify as female.
Mm-hmm. But I hope that they know men can't breastfeed.
They don't. And it's a funny story until you're in the medical profession and you're not allowed to tell the truth. You're not allowed to say what is biologically indisputable. And you're not talking about you know, what's the band, Mother's Milk, with Flea.
You've had too many chicken tenders.
Come on.
What, the band, say it.
You're culturally illiterate that you can't take on my.
I don't know. Is there a band called Mother's Milk?
No, it's an album. Red Hot Chili Peppers, of course.
Well, gosh.
Honestly, please try to keep up. When I stumble, you're supposed to pick me up. So you have things like that. Then you have the disparate treatment of, say, Martin Kulldorff, friend of the show, Harvard Medical School professor, as compared to Washington football team head coach, Dr., quotation marks, Ron Rivera, former Bears linebacker.
I remember him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ron Rivera, his fact-free rants on vaccines get amplified by TMZ and then everywhere else, Sports Illustrated, then TMZ, then everywhere else. He's really upset about the bunch of misinformation one particular network is putting out about the vaccines leading people to die. You got some effing a-holes that are putting a bunch of misinformation out there leading people to die. It's frustrating to me. These people are allowed to have a platform. One specific news agency, every time they have someone on, I'm not a doctor, but the vaccines don't work. Or I'm not an epidemiologist, but the vaccines are going to give you a third nipple and make you sterile. Come on, that to me, that should not be allowed. First of all, that's complete fabrication. That's not what's happening on Fox News, which is what Rivera is obviously referring to. That's not happening on conservative talk radio. Nobody's saying anything of the sort. And certainly people like Martin Kulldorff aren't saying that. And yet Martin Kulldorff is suffering the same fate over at LinkedIn as Dr. Robert Malone, who's credited at least as one of the inventors of the mRNA vaccine technology. Got banned on LinkedIn, then reinstated. Kulldorff has had two of his posts removed.
From LinkedIn? On LinkedIn?
For violating its misinformation policy. I mean,
he's a professor at Harvard Medicine.
Well, I know, but this
he's
is what's
a
happening.
Doctor.
This is what's happening. And so it's funny when it's, you know, we're joking about men chest feeding. And then it's all part of the tapestry of the totalitarian. And it's happening in medicine, too. So that nothing I won't surrender, including my life. Just don't call me a name. That's the culture. For more on this, pleased to be joined by John Murawski. He's a reporter with Real Clear Investigations, and he's done a really good two-part look at the impact of this sort of ideological orthodoxy in medical schools and healthcare as an industry. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
We've seen this throughout COVID. You have medical professionals have taken ridiculous positions, like, for example, in an era of social distancing and mask wearing, it was okay that those protesting the George Floyd murder were not social distancing, not wearing masks because their cause was righteous. So that's somehow the morality of what you're doing somehow relates to how a virus transmits. Medical doctors, epidemiologists saying things like that, in addition to the professional associations like the AMA, New England Journal of Medicine, taking up the matter of applying critical race theory and atonement to the medical profession.
That's correct. that is exactly what's happening. Critical race theory is sweeping through medicine at a breakneck pace, and it's causing a certain amount of culture shock because critical race theory does things very differently than we did things before critical race theory. And the main goal of critical race theory is to redistribute power, wealth, and economic access to achieve equity. In other words, what they believe to be fair outcomes or equal outcomes or fair outcomes. And the problem right now with that is that for very complex reasons, some ethnic groups get better grades and better test scores than other ethnic groups. And so those measures of excellence or measures of ability need to be suspended to achieve equity in medicine, to sort of bring in more black doctors. And the reason, the thinking behind that is that actually white doctors are causing harm to black patients through, not through any deliberate, not because they're, you know, they are secret Klansmen or anything like that, just because of, you know, what we've heard, the term unconscious bias or implicit bias. And this has catastrophic events, actually, catastrophic consequences, supposedly, for black patients. And there are hundreds of studies that keep on repeating this mantra. And so the medical profession is now, you know, deciding that the solution in the George Floyd moment is to, we need to have an equal distribution of black doctors to treating black patients, or otherwise this is going to cause, you know, irreparable harm to black patients. Well, you know, it's all very complex and controversial. And of course, not everybody, many people don't agree with this, but this is sort of what is sweeping through the American Medical Association, through the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association and other very prestigious medical schools and medical journals. It's, you know, it's starting from the top. It's very much, it's not bottom up. It's very much from the top down. It's a new elite worldview that you've talked about many times and I've written about, well, and others have written about.
Yeah, yeah. Have any doctors pushed back? And if they have, has there been any consequences?
Yeah, a few doctors have pushed back. One doctor, who's a cardiologist at the University of Pittsburgh, published a paper basically disagreeing with affirmative action in medicine. He basically said it's illegal and it is discriminatory and it is ultimately counterproductive and not good for patients. And he was basically demoted. He was blocked from having access with students, with fellows and residents. And later they reversed the part about the ban on the students. So he can actually teach students, but he can't have contact with the fellows and the residents. And the thinking there is that his views are actually causing harm to black and brown students. They're being harmed by this, by being exposed to this, because they're presuming that he's a bigot and he's bringing these, if you oppose affirmative action, then of course you are a bigot. So only a bigot would oppose affirmative action. And so so what they oppose is bigotry, except they just define bigotry in a completely different way than you and I probably oppose bigotry too, but we just define it differently. So their definition is very broad and it captures a lot of behavior that presumably before would not have been considered bigot. It just would have been a difference of opinion on a complex issue.
So the atonement piece, the number of black doctors needs to be representative of the percentage of blacks in the population. So 13%.
13% is the average nationwide, right? But I mean, if you go to Washington D.C. or if you went to Detroit or certain, cities that have a lot of, you might be over like 60 or 75%.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. And so, in order to get there, we may have to lower the MCAT scores and academic record, and so on and so forth. Just because, as you said, it's complicated. There's a lot of reasons, but number one, there's just not that many. Relatively speaking, black Americans that go into medicine, medical school, and then go on to careers in medicine. There are some, and there's great black doctors, just like great white doctors and Asian doctors and everybody else. But we want to, you know, play games with the standards to achieve a racial mix. Okay, fine. So then,
For example, they're eliminating honors programs, like Northwestern University Medical School, eliminating an honors program. There are three tests that you take in medical school, and three major exams that you take during the course of med school. And so the first one, they decided to make it just a pass-fail to lower the barrier a little bit. And the thinking behind that is that the test scores don't really measure your ability. What they really measure is how oppressed you've been. And so the reason that black people do worse on these tests is because they're living in poverty. And the reason they're living in poverty is because of systemic racism. And it's through no fault of their own that they find themselves in these conditions. And
but that's dangerous to do.
I mean, it raises a lot of, it can have a lot of downstream unintended consequences. And we don't know what those consequences are. Now, I think most people would agree that if you're a pediatrician, if you're a pediatrician, your mom, and you're going to send your dog, your infant to a pediatrician, you don't really care whether that pediatrician aced calculus or whether that pediatrician, whether she or he got a B or a C in calculus. So in other words, there are certain standards. The medical school standards are very rigid and very high for everybody. But most of us probably think, well, it doesn't really matter. 20 years down the road, you're not going to ask your doctor, well, what was your grade in calculus before I allow you to examine my child? So some of these measures, we might even agree, all of us might agree, that they don't measure, you know, they don't tell us everything we need to know. But of course, with critical race theory, the changes are so sweeping and absolute and totalizing that, and they're being carried out at such a breakneck pace that no one seems to be stopping to think about the consequences, long-term consequences. The fixation is on getting to equity. And because we are underrepresented, we've got to sort of rejigger the system, morally rebalance society until we get to equity.
But critical race theory, critical race theory is sort of socio-political in its nature. The trans aspect is anti-biology in nature, and so you know, marry the two, how trans plus critical race theory is, because we're focusing a lot on race, and that's certainly part of it. But this trans movement, per the American Breastfeeding Association and so many other examples, that celebrated medical professor at one of the Ivy Leagues who apologized to his students for essentially intimating that only women get pregnant. I mean, that has an impact on medicine, too.
Yeah, you know, where that comes from is out of French postmodernism and other Western ideas that have long been in circulation but never really entered the mainstream. And that is that social reality is constructed, that all of our understanding of the world, understanding of the universe is basically almost like a figment of our imagination. These are social constructions. So gender, race, you know, other things that we sort of thought were like rooted in biology are actually really socio-political worldviews. And, you know, it makes more sense for race than for gender, but with gender and sex, you have to sort of remember we did evolve out of animals, and these animals did seem to have sex. So at one point we were if you buy into evolution, I think most people do that. At one point, if we were primates, these primates are male and female, and they act like male, we don't really see any, you know, gender fluidity in those creatures, or certainly mice or birds or worms or amoeba. And suddenly when we achieve human consciousness, then gender becomes something completely different. That's the tricky part of it. But yes, the idea is it is a social construction, and we can reconstruct these social ideas in such ways to achieve fair societies. That's the thinking behind it. But in order to do that, you have to basically make gender and sex disappear.
Well, I've got an idea then. I mean, just to fold in with the identitarians, and, you know, this grade school in Atlanta is way ahead of me, but black doctors treat black patients, white Catholic doctors treat white Catholic patients, trans doctors treat trans patients. We'll just segregate it. We don't need by law. Yeah. We'll just do it culturally, like that school in Atlanta that has black teachers teaching black kids and white teachers teaching white kids.
Yeah, then I need a special doctor who changes his mind every day.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, this
indecision's great in the medical field.
But I tell you, I mean, and then, you know, for the patient, you take your chances based on who you think is getting preferential treatment based on their identity rather than their quality of education and academic record and performance as a resident and so on and so forth. You roll the dice. You know, your choice, your body, your choice, your culture. For John Murawski, reporter, realclearinvestigations.com. I'll tweet out his two-part series on these issues we've been discussing. Very good, as always. John Murawski, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. It's two parts and three articles, actually, in those two parts. But thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-3030. 5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.